Welcome to episode 25. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health, just a reminder to all of our standalone community health members that the July meeting for HRIR managers is a special meeting that also includes CEOs. As we continue to work our way through 2017, which is a major year for bargaining for this group, we'll be having a combined special meeting on the 19th of July at VHAA to talk about the progress of enterprise bargaining and in particular the progress of wage negotiations so that we can continue those negotiations with the various unions with confidence. With regards to our health service members, we have conducted the most recent SDPPWG for the health and allied managers and administrative workers. Unlike the other SDPPWGs, this one meets on a monthly basis rather than a bi-monthly basis. The next major piece of work for Health and Allied will be with respect to the clerical structure and to the admin structure and that translation process. Thank you to those members who have provided feedback that's been collated, and we'll be developing a bulletin that addresses that process regarding those matters shortly. We have had to reschedule the July SDPPWG meeting for that group to facilitate the availability of all parties. Thank you also to members of the overarching reference group who have continued to work their way through the implementation issues, and for the participation of all members in our monthly HRIR manager meetings. The introduction of those regular meetings for each of our divisions of membership has meant that we have gone from speaking to about 10% of our membership on a monthly basis to now over 50%. So thank you to your participation. That's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me for this week's discussion is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor and former creative consultant to One Direction, Tim Nagel. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart. Good to be here.
Tim, would you do the honours and reveal the clue for this week's subject?
Sure.
So for the benefit of those who are listening rather than watching, could you describe the object?
It's a little golden book entitled Scuffy the Tugboat.
And based on that object, what would you say that this week's subject for discussion is?
It's a boating episode.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. Despite its cheery exterior, Scuffy the Tugboat is a journey into a heart of darkness, much like Joseph Conrad's book of the same name. It's a book in which Scuffy, the tugboat, the eponymous character, questions the reason for his existence. It's essentially a search for meaning. And that's the subject for discussion today, agreement interpretation. It's perhaps an occupational hazard for many of our members that they're called upon to either interpret agreements or to respond to interesting or creative interpretations of agreements. So I thought it would be useful if we went through some of the principles that underpin the appropriate interpretation of these industrial instruments. I think it's fair to say by way of background that industrial instruments are the mix of the negotiated and the inherited. That is, provisions within agreements that have been inherited from previous industrial instruments and which both parties to a negotiation have agreed to not vary, lest they should vary the status quo. So I guess the key thing with regards to this is we're going to talk about the principles that you should use to interpret an industrial agreement.
So in terms of those principles, is there some guidance with how to approach these things?
So we're going to talk a lot about a particular full bench decision of the Fair Work Commission. It's a decision called the Australian Meat Industry Employees Union and Golden Cockerel. What the full bench did in that particular decision is outline 10 principles that are relevant to the interpretation of an agreement. They didn't describe them as a top 10 as such, but let's pretend that they did. So starting with the first of those principles, it's that the Acts Interpretation Act 1901 does not apply to the construction of an enterprise agreement made under the Fair Work Act.
So the Acts Interpretation Act doesn't apply. What is the Acts Interpretation Act?
So the Acts Interpretation Act is a piece of legislation that sets the rules for interpreting laws. Essentially, enterprise agreements made under the Fair Work Act don't fall into that category. So the Acts Interpretation Act is of no more relevance to the interpretation of an enterprise agreement than it is to interpreting the difficult passages of Moby Dick.
Okay.
That leads us on to principle number two. Principle number two is, in construing an enterprise agreement, it's first necessary to determine whether the agreement has a plain meaning or contains an ambiguity.
So does that mean that the agreement must be interpreted literally?
No, that's not the case. We've already established that agreements aren't subject to the Acts Interpretation Act. What this provision is trying to communicate is that when you come to interpret any written document, your starting place is always with the words themselves.
So if you're looking for a plain meaning, does that mean or suggest that a narrow approach should be applied when interpreting the agreements?
There's more to it than that. Before we get to the issue of ambiguity, there's a case called Cux versus CSR. And it concerns an award, but the same principles apply to the interpretation of agreements. And there's a great passage there by His Honour Justice Madgwick, and I'll read it out because it's quite beautiful. And I think members will recognise the relevance of it to enterprise agreements.
Quite often quoted, I imagine.
It's quite often quoted in any arbitration. So for any member who has gone through an arbitration at the Fair Work Commission, they'll be familiar with Cuck's case. It is trite that narrow or pedantic approaches to the interpretation of an award are misplaced. The search for the meaning intended by the framers of the document, bearing in mind that such framers were likely of a practical bent of mind, they may well have been more concerned with expressing an intention in ways likely to have been understood in the context of the relevant industry and industrial relations environment than with legal niceties or jargon. Thus, for example, it is justifiable to read the award to give effect to its evident purposes, having regard to such context, despite mere inconsistencies or infelicities of expression which might tend to some other reading. And meanings which avoid inconvenience or injustice may reasonably be strained for. For reasons such as these, expressions which may have been held in the case of other instruments to have been used to mean particular things may sensibly and properly be held to mean something else in the document at hand. It's quite a beautiful phrase that His Honour put forward. And so whilst you do begin with the words as they appear on the page, what you need to do is avoid a narrow or pedantic approach to interpretation. If it was about a literal interpretation of the words, there'd be one principle for interpretation and not ten.
It's really about the context, isn't it?
Well, getting to context, that takes us really to principle number three. Regard may be had to evidence of surrounding circumstances to assist in determining whether an ambiguity exists.
So what does it mean by surrounding circumstances?
That's really that point of context that you were raising before. It's a far more complete consideration than simply the ink on the page. That is, determining whether there's an ambiguity is of itself that requires you to not confine yourself simply to the words, but to consider the broader circumstance. The significance of this principle is that surrounding circumstances can be considered to determine whether there's an ambiguity even before you get to interpretation. That takes us to principle four. Principle four is that if the agreement has a plain meaning, evidence of the surrounding circumstances will not be admitted to contradict the plain language of the agreement.
So that sort of places limits on the surrounding circumstances in a way, doesn't it?
Interpretation is not an invitation to rewrite the agreement. Going back to Cuck's case, it talks about meanings that avoid inconvenience and injustice and that they can be reasonably strained for. But that's a different thing from rewriting the plain language of the agreement.
So that's the first four. What's the fifth principle?
The fifth principle is that if the language of the agreement is ambiguous, that is, once an ambiguity is established or susceptible to more than one meaning, then evidence of surrounding circumstances will be admissible to aid the interpretation of the agreement. So that is, once an ambiguity is established, you can then consider the surrounding circumstances to assist you to understand what the agreement means.
So it seems like the identification of that ambiguity is almost the first step.
It is. It's an essential pathway for the purposes of these principles.
In terms of that principle, what kind of circumstances can be considered?
So principle number six talks about admissible evidence of surrounding circumstances is evidence of the objective framework of fact and will include a number of things. Just want to emphasise that word objective as opposed to subjective. That is, it's not what a particular person feels or believes, but it's something that can be determined objectively. And examples include evidence of prior negotiations to the extent that negotiations tend to establish objective background facts known to all parties and the subject matter of the agreement.
Mm.
Agreements don't come out of nothing. They have a history, and the negotiations are an essential part of that history, and they're an important part to understanding the term of an agreement. Other examples are notorious facts of which knowledge is to be presumed, and evidence of matters in common contemplation and constituting a common assumption. Examples of a notorious fact, for example, if the NES, for instance, the introduction of the NES, created a new prescribed minimum entitlement for a range of matters, and that is something that for those agreements that were negotiated immediately in the aftermath of the NES, it might be assumed that that is a notorious fact.
I think we've had some examples of that where the length of a day has been considered or the length of a shift.
Indeed, and we varied an agreement in order to remove an ambiguity on that particular point. The issue with principle number six is history can be important, and it's worth emphasising that reference to common contemplation. That is, it's not a reference to what one particular party happened to think.
So that's the first six principles. What's the seventh principle?
So the seventh is that the resolution of a disputed construction of an agreement will turn on the language of the agreement, understood having regard to its context and its purpose. Context and purpose. Clauses in an agreement cannot be severed from their context and purpose. If you do that, you will inevitably misunderstand the clause.
It's what links it together, really, isn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And in terms of purpose, what is meant by purpose in that principle?
So when we talk about interpreting agreements, we often refer to a purposive approach to interpreting an agreement, and that's really the opposite of taking a narrow or pedantic approach. The words on the page of an agreement are an attempt to give effect to a particular purpose, and generally speaking, members should interpret agreement in clauses in a way that gives effect to that purpose.
And we've talked a little bit about context in terms of today's discussion, but what is meant by context?
So context is addressed in Principle 8. Context could appear from the text of the agreement when it is viewed as a whole, the arrangement of the agreement, the legislative context under which the agreement was made and the environment in which it operates. It's not an exhaustive list, but the point of that list is that it's making the point that it's a broader consideration.
Mm. So in terms of Principle 9?
So Principle 9 talks about that where the common intention of the parties is sought to be identified, regard is not had to the subjective intentions or expectations of the parties. A common intention is identified objectively, that is by reference to that which a reasonable person would understand, by the language the parties have used to express their agreement. Again, that emphasis on objective rather than subjective. It's a question of what the parties intended, not what did one of the parties intend.
Mm. And in terms of those surrounding documents to get context and purpose, would something like a log of claim, for instance, be relevant?
I think so, particularly where it's asserted that a particular entitlement has changed. It goes back to the history. So a lot of our clauses have varied slightly from one agreement to the next. They've been updated, they've been reworded for clarity. But in terms of these, of the substantive changes, those are usually the result of a claim that one or other or both parties have made with respect to that. So a log of claims is an example of a piece of material that might provide some valuable context for understanding a particular clause of an agreement.
And I think that leaves us with one more principle to talk about.
It does. Rounding out our top 10 for the Golden Cockerel case, the task of interpreting an agreement does not involve rewriting the agreement to achieve what might be regarded as a fair or just outcome. The task is always one of interpreting the agreement produced by the parties. The job of the Commission is to interpret the agreement, not to rewrite it.
So, I mean, that's really interesting in terms of that there are limitations on that interpretation process consistent with those principles. What would be the, if you had to summarise the important points of that case, what would you say the important take-home messages are?
Yeah, I think it can be summed up really by that decision in Cucks, where it talks about that you don't take a narrow or pedantic approach, that you bear in mind that those who wrote the agreement were probably of a practical bent and were writing it with a view to what makes sense for their particular industry. It's not about taking a purely literal approach to the particular sentence that suits you. One of the great dangers with interpreting agreements is that people interpret it in a way that suits their own purpose. Many members will have at times reviewed a particular term of an agreement, and a particular interpretation may have appealed to them on the basis of its convenience as such, but there's a bigger picture to take into account. It's also the case that members from time to time will be the subject of a demand from an employee or from a union about how a particular clause can or should be interpreted, which again takes that narrow or pedantic approach as opposed to that purposive approach that considers the context and the meaning in an overall sense. Members recently will have received correspondence from VAPA with regards to Clause 91 of the Allied Health Professionals Agreement. And from our perspective, we've made it clear that we disagree. That is, that's an instance where a long-standing clause requires the advertising of vacancies when people leave to ensure that there is not a delay in filling that vacancy. But a interpretation has been put forward which suggests that what that clause means is that a full internal process must be gone through before an external process can be considered, and that if external advertising is being proposed, then the union needs to be contacted and they may dispute that decision. That's not what the clause has ever meant. There was no claim made by any party to alter its purpose. And from our perspective, that would be an example of a narrow or pedantic approach to interpretation at odds with the purpose. The purpose of the clause is to avoid delay. The proposed interpretation guarantees delay as such. So I think it's just worth members taking that purposive approach and just thinking through what the history of a particular clause is and what it's trying to do.
I think if you can remove that subjectivity from that discussion too and try and rely on objectivity, it sort of almost creates a collaborative process for determining meaning as opposed to just a combative one.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, objectivity is really an essential part of interpreting as opposed to subjectivity. Tim, I feel as though we have been on a journey. I think probably the only fitting way to conclude is to return to Scuffy the Tugboat and see how his adventures ended up in the book, Scuffy the Tugboat. Scuffy is home now with the man with the polka dot tie and his little boy. He sails from one end of the bathtub to the other. "This is the place for a red-painted tugboat," said Scuffy. "And this is the life for me." Chilling. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks, Scuffy.